Hi, I am Nikhil Rawal and you're listening to Working with Gen Z, a show where I have conversations with local and global experts who will help us understand the hope and aspirations of the Gen Z generation. The Gen Z generation is the demographic cohort succeeding the millennials. This show is going to examine all facets of the Gen Z life and the critical factors for winning their hearts and minds. We'll go deep to uncover what motivates them and their mindsets, plus expectations from an employer, brands, their views on money, entrepreneurship value, learning, and much, much more.
Welcome to another episode of Working with Gen Z. Friend, there's an old poem by Rudyard Kipling that says, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. But anyone who is in the business world, in the professional world, will agree that companies today, people today are so interconnected and interdependent that we have to work with colleagues around the world. And it doesn't matter if it's a small company or large company. Now, whether it's in a company like iPhone manufacturing in India, whether it's the rest of the world trying to look at German expertise for their cars, or whatever it is, we have to deal with companies and colleagues who have certain expertise. And therefore, the corollary to that is that when you deal with colleagues from other part of the world, right, there is a certain nuance or a cultural aspect in terms of not just getting to know them, but how do you actually become proficient at it? Because this is not something where you say that I do it one time and that's it, right? The world is increasingly so interconnected that that's a fundamental skill almost expected from all managers around the world. And to help us with that, to understand the various nuances, to decode some of the myths and myths around the world of intercultural, multicultural, culturalism, and all the different words that are going to use in that domain is our expert, Robert Gibson. Because a lot of times, people have this notion that if I travel outside, I think I'm culturally very savvy. But I think we'll try and unpeel some of that to figure out that what do we actually mean by a cultural expert. And to help me with that is my guest, Robert Gibson. Robert, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so Robert, just as we do with every guest, I'm going to briefly read your bio or a profile, and you asked me kindly to keep it brief. So friends, to give a quick snap of what a rich background that Robert brings us, Robert has 30 years of experience of global competence development in business and education. He was responsible for intercultural training for the multinational engineering corporation Siemens for more than 18 years and has been an adjunct faculty at the Bologna School Business School since 2012, teaching the global MBA program. His latest book, Bridge the Culture Gap, A Toolkit for Effective Collaboration in the Diverse Global Workplace, published by N.B. Hachette in 2021. He lives in Munich, Germany. So Robert, welcome once again, and thank you for taking time to help us with this episode.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, I'm very pleased to talk to you.
So Robert, before I dive in, I have a lot of questions on the topic, but I'd like for you to share anything more, perhaps on your background or the work that you do for our viewers. I know that you very kindly asked me to keep the profile very brief, but anything else would you like to share or that you wanted, let us know in terms of your work, your background, etc.
Okay, I think the key thing about my background is that I'm involved with culture from a couple of different angles. So one thing is I was born in the UK, but I've lived in Germany for over 30 years. So I've experienced within Europe cultural differences. But also something that I think is equally important, actually maybe even more important, is the fact that I've moved between the world of universities and the world of business. I found those are actually also two a bit different cultures. So I really enjoy that, working with business clients, or working, for instance, at the as you mentioned, at the Bologna Business School.
Sure, excellent. So lovely, Robert. Let's begin. I'm going to dive straight into our question now. I want to start with something very simple, basic, just to help our viewers with the basic fundamentals are just kind of the concept, yeah, the definition. So maybe we can start by you helping us to understand, the word culture, because, and when I say the word culture, I guess People often interchangeably use terms like interculture, cross-culture, multicultural, transculture. So what is the distinction there?
I think that's important actually to know what we're talking about, because when I'm using culture, I'm not really talking just about music and art and those things, sort of high culture. I'm talking about what I would call a shared system of attitudes, values, beliefs, meanings, and behavior. Shared system of attitudes, values, beliefs, meanings, and behavior. So can belong to any group, actually. It's not just a national cultural group, it can be any group of people. It's the unique thing about it is it's something which people share. You can call it the mindset, or Gerd Hofstede, one of the pioneers of intercultural research, he uses the word software of the mind. Maybe that's a little bit too mechanical. He was an engineer, so he liked those sorts of words. Or I like a definition by the Canadian interculturalist Nancy Adler. She talks about culture is what most people do most of the time. So it's about groups, and that's important. The second part of your question, really, about these terms, as you say, there are a lot of terms around, and they're all fairly close to each other, and to some extent interchangeable.
Sure.
But I think there are some distinctions. I mean, we talk about multicultural society. That really is referring to the fact that different cultural groups, different ethnic groups, for instance, exist in a society, like in India or like where I come from in London. If you start talking about cross-culture, then you're really thinking of comparing cultures. So you're saying, okay, let's have a look at these two or more cultures and compare them. The next one, intercultural, is really stressing, and that's the word I use most because I find it the most practical. And that's a word which really describes the interaction between the cultures. So cultures coming together, what you described at the beginning, East meets West or whatever. And this is a relatively new term that you also mentioned, transculture. And that's actually, I think, a very interesting development. That's where people are saying we need to go beyond culture and focus actually not so much on difference, but on commonalities. What do we have in common? Because actually finding commonalities, although being aware of the difference, that's the secret actually to successful prints of business across borders.
Right. Well, excellent. No, I think this is very helpful just to really understand kind of the basic definitions. And while, like you say, they're interchangeable, there is a kind of a distinct difference in some of these terms. So thank you for that. I think that that lays the foundation. Let me begin, Robert, since our focus is on the Generation Z as the focus of our podcast. And obviously, as you know, that when we talk about this generation, this is, you know, a group of, folks who will just be entering the workforce, right? So the eldest of the Generation Z is about 25, 26, depending on, you know, when you look at the starting age of that generation, which means that they're just beginning their professional career. Now, as we said, irrespective of where you're based, whether you are a mid-sized company or a region company, there is a very good chance that, you know, your company at some point, or perhaps in your professional career, you will likely to deal with a colleague in London or somewhere in the West or in Singapore or Australia or somewhere in India, right? And so it's one thing for people to say that, yeah, I've met and I've spoken to someone, but how do we actually, when you think from the Gen Z's perspective, how do we build more mature skills, right, of what we call cross-culture skills? So if I'm a Gen Z entering the professional workforce, right, what are the ways in which companies can help build a set of these skills, right? I don't even know if I can call them skills, but maybe just the competency over a career. What have you seen?
Yeah, I think that's what you said at the beginning really resonated with me about it's not enough just to travel, for instance. I think a lot of people that I met in my work inside a corporation, which was a very international organization, we were in 190 countries. Had, when I was there, a large number of people, 450,000 people in 190 countries. And I was traveling around a lot. And there's this sort of business traveler thing where people go around and they think, actually, oh, I'm sort of super intercultural because I've traveled to all these places. I mean, at the high point, I was going to three different continents in a week, you know, and I didn't actually know where I was, really. One time I went to Sao Paulo, and then back to Munich and then to Hong Kong. And I was completely jet lagged. It was sort of exciting, but it was crazy. And I wouldn't pretend that I know about Brazil or China from that experience. Yeah. But I think people sometimes make that mistake of equating that. Of course, this experience is really valuable, but it's really a question of what you do with that experience. And that's where I think it's very important to connect that with learning. And this is what many companies do to create ways of learning through formal training and education. And I would hope that somebody of that generation, you would look for a company perhaps which is offering you learning opportunities. And the learning doesn't have to be formal training. It can also be like mentoring. You can work together with somebody, for instance, from a different generation. I mean, I found that great before I left the company that I was working for. The last 2 years, I wanted to make a handover of my topic, which was intercultural training, to a younger colleague. And my boss, I think it was very good. He put us together. And I found it very, very interesting also for me. And she said she appreciated it. She came with a lot of new ideas. And I came with my experience. And so this sort of peer learning from your peers, learning on the job is very important. The other thing, which is really very central in my book, which really in a way trains this, and I would call it a skill, is training yourself to reflect on those experiences and reflect on your own reaction. So what I use in the book is an approach I call the OAR approach, which is OAR. So I say to people, first of all, you need to really focus on your observation skills. So when you're dealing with people who are different from yourself, either from different countries or just different in generation or different region or just different from you or different gender, try to observe how things are, observe what's happening before you start coming to some conclusion. Because often we're actually triggered by people's behavior and it sets off some emotions perhaps. And then we react and we evaluate, say, oh, that person was rude. That's what often people say about Germans. They say, oh, they're rude. Well, they might be rude to you, but actually they would consider it to be honest and direct.
Mm.
And my British friends always are very polite and they think that's good to be polite, but the Germans say we never know what they think. And this is an issue that many have with India. Germans that say, the Indians always say yes, and then nothing happens, you know? And they're not their head in a strange way, and we're not sure what's going on. So observe, first of all. Second one, A is for analyze. Then you can start thinking about, well, what's behind this? Is it a difference in communication style? Or is it something to do with this individual? Maybe they are a difficult individual. Maybe they are rude. But is it something deeper than that? And maybe it's something to do with the fact that actually, for instance, in Germany, often people are quite direct in their communication. Not all the time, but that's a tendency. And the last stage is to really reflect and recommend. So reflecting on this, thinking, okay, how did that affect me? And recommending either to yourself or to other people, what can we do about that? And so if for instance, the German finds the British too polite, I train them to ask some questions. Well, what do you mean by that when you say my talk was interesting? And what was interesting about it? And then they find out if it really was interesting or if it was just a polite phrase. Or if the Indian says yes, then to ask them, well, when will you deliver it? Or tell me what you're going to be doing next week. And they go, oh, I'm on holiday. Well, then, you know, they're not going to be doing it. And yes doesn't mean yes. Yeah. So I hope I don't want to stereotype Indians, but that's just something I've heard so often from my German colleagues. So I think it's those three things. Experience. So try to get into as many contact with many people who are different from yourself as you can. Go to lunch with people who basically you think at first sight there's someone who's completely alien to me. Go do it and have a tea or a coffee or something with them. And then use learning opportunities and also then take the time out to reflect. And unfortunately, the last phase is what people often neglect because they're very busy and they just keep going. But I think that's a very valuable thing. And as I say, I give some tips for that in the book about how you can do that. And there are exercises to practice that. It's a bit like actually sport. You know, it's not, as you said at the beginning, it's not a one-off thing. You say, okay, today I want to run the marathon and I go to the fitness studio and do half an hour on the treadmill. That's not going to make me run the marathon. I need to train over a very long time to do that. And intercultural competence development is a lifetime thing. The last point I want to make is actually about companies. Companies now are doing something quite interesting. I think it's been accelerated by the pandemic, but it was happening before that. And that's what they call it, learning ecosystems. So they're setting up structures for learning. And this can be web-based, of course. So at Siemens, we had something called the Learning World, where we had different topics. And we put all the resources for that topic onto a platform. So the resources could be training modules, could be videos, could be articles, could be interviews with people, could be best practice. But it can also be just a list of names of people you could contact to get some aspiring partner to talk to inside the company. Or it could be if you want to book a training program or a formal coaching or something. But a lot of it was happening outside of that formal training situation.
Sure. No, excellent. I think you mentioned many things there, right, from the ability to sort of just gain firsthand experience, and then to speaking to colleagues internally, doing a mutual mentoring, which can be very, very effective. But I really like the simple framework of the OAR, observe, analyze, reflect. And even observing, I think oftentimes we just undermine that. Like, can we carefully observe without, you know, judging into something to say that?
Absolutely. Like, I recently posted something on LinkedIn, a picture of a restaurant in London, a Chinese restaurant in London. Uh-huh. And I just wanted to say I'd been to London and we'd had this, and I was amazed to find this Chinese restaurant. But I got thousands of people looked at this, and lots of people commented and said, oh yeah, they serve those terrible chicken wings. And I wrote back and said, these are not chicken wings. There's no chicken there at all. And this person was really angry. She said, but I'm sure they're chicken wings. I thought, well, I was there. I ate them, you know. She was singed because she was used to something that was fried and a certain size and looked like chicken wings. Yeah. But there was no way these were chicken wings. And it's, we see what we want to see. And as we know, and this is something I also think is very interesting, we have a cultural filter in our brain, what we see. Mm-hmm. So we're brought up to see certain things, and then we tend to evaluate it. So if you've had a school teacher who wore a particular type of glasses, horn-rimmed glasses or something, and then you see somebody applying for a job and you're the manager, you might say, and you didn't like this teacher, then you may, without really knowing it, be a bit biased against this person, and it's misleading you. So the brain is filtering things all the time because it can't cope with all the impressions that we get all the time. And it's using the cultural background that we have, what we experience in our group, in our life, which is unique to us, of course, to filter that. And so we see, and I'm sure you know when you ask people, they see an accident and everybody sees a different perspective of that accident. Yeah. Depending on where they were standing when the two cars crashed together, they will report on different things. So it's being aware of your own wiring, actually, and how are you wired and what are my things. And I find I'm not exempt from this. You know, I find myself doing that all the time and misinterpreting situations. So take time for this observation phase.
No, I like it because as is an excellent example, because we just I think we tend to jump to conclusion quickly, and like you said, it's like building a muscle. It you know, you have to train yourself. It's the confirmation bias, rather, I would say, where we look for what we think, what we want to see. Now, Robert, you obviously travel so extensively around the world, and do you and you mentioned about the learning ecosystem. Are there any companies, I mean, just generally, whatever that you feel can share, who are very good about kind of, you know, building this kind of cultural quotient into their system? I know that a lot of multinational, like we had a client for more than 10 years, and they're one of the top, you know, sort of the top 30 companies, Dow companies in the US, and they had a huge center in India. Now, we used to do a program where we used to get people from 20, 25 countries now. And in the classic way, we had about five or six people on a table, and then everybody would start talking into their own language till the time the global CEO was once kind of there as a guest. And he said, look, we can never be a global company if we don't have the courtesy to respect the person next to you and be mindful that, look, you know, there's someone else on the table who doesn't understand what you're saying, and it's rude to them, and it's not a good thing. So if you really want to call yourself and become a global manager, like, start doing these small things, right? So I'm wondering, any companies that you feel like are really, like, we obviously heard in companies like Unilever and so on, but But any other companies that come to mind, like we've done a good job?
I think that, I come across quite a few of those companies in Germany. It's not so that Germany is better, but Germany is very heavily dependent on exports. And so I think people have, and I think in Germany, a lot of people are actually quite curious about foreign cultures. When I go to see friends, German friends, I notice they always have quite a lot of travel books. They like to travel and they go all over the world. And I think in business, I think this export thing has driven people to realize they need to do it. So at Siemens, where I was, we had a whole department for this topic, you know, and we were, that was my job to coordinate that. So that did exist within the company. And I know that other companies also do that. The car manufacturers that you mentioned earlier in Germany, of course, like Audi and BMW, they take the topic also very, very seriously. So I wouldn't pretend to have an overview of that, but I think that's something that maybe if your audience they have an interview, I would suggest they maybe ask about that sort of thing. What do you do to foster diversity, to foster intercultural competence? And if they are sort of blank or don't really reply, then you should be a little bit suspicious. And it doesn't, as I said before, it doesn't have to mean that they've got a training program. You go on 3-day seminars, but they've just got some idea of how they deal with that, or a policy that they have. For instance, like with that language thing, you describe something which I've experienced many times, because I facilitated many meetings, international meetings, and I found, okay, the meeting was in English, but then when we had the dinner, people would all sit together. So all the Germans were in one corner, all the Chinese were in one corner, and I ended up then trying to structure that. So I actually gave people a place setting and said, you sit not with people you know. I mean, it's a little bit mean, because actually when you're tired at the end of the day and you're speaking English as a foreign language, which was the case for many of the people, then you want to have a bit of a break from that. It's quite stressful. Yeah. But I think that's really important. And in terms of language thing, which you mentioned, I think it's also very important that the native speakers learn how to speak clear English. So I did some work also with them, because often I found that the native speakers of English were not understood sometimes by the people who had English as a second or third language. And often they were talking too quickly, particularly, I must say, embarrassingly, my colleagues from UK, where they had no real feeling for language. Anyway. In India, you're sort of lucky, because I'm always amazed by, I remember doing an Indian-German workshop, and the German says, why do we do have everything in English? Why can't the Indians learn German? And I looked at an Indian colleague and I said, can you just tell me how many languages you speak? And he said, well, actually only about 5 or something, you know, and he listed these languages that he spoke to various members of the family, to his... I said, okay. And then I said to the German, how many languages do you speak? So I think this language issue is an issue too. That's one side of this. But if a company is really inclusive and is diverse, they really need to have some approach to this and to help it, because it doesn't happen automatically. It's got to be part of the policy. And so I wouldn't want to name any further companies. I think most internationally successful companies are doing this in some way.
Yeah. Now, what can be the on the other side, Robert? What can be some of the? You obviously have been teaching experience MBA programs, and obviously there are people who come from all parts of the world. But despite the fact when we say the world is connected and interdependent and all of that, right? There's probably a huge scope for companies to become better. So, are there some mistakes that companies make? In other words, like just push someone at the deep end of the pool, or just hey, here's a young engineer and we want you to travel to Thailand, or what are some of the things that companies shouldn't do? In other words, what are the basic mistakes that could happen, like no training or what have you seen? Like, are there things that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I feel is that with this topic there is a tendency with some people to do one of two things, either to underestimate the role of culture. So they say, we're really global. We've been global for 100 years. And We sell things all over the world, and we travel a lot, like we mentioned before. So we don't need anything. You know, we don't need any help. That's one tendency. Yeah. And then another tendency, which is quite interesting, is when people have discovered the culture thing, they start reading a few books, and then they think everything has to do with culture. And so, oh my goodness. And then they get paralyzed, actually. We had an issue, actually, with people, Germans, going to Saudi Arabia, where the HR department phoned me up, and they said in Saudi Arabia, and said, can you stop doing this intercultural training? Because the people are so frightened of making a mistake that they then are inactive. You know, they're just sitting there worried that they're going to do something wrong.
Yeah.
So this the two extremes, because it's not everything is explained by culture, but culture, as somebody said to me, is like salt in the soup. You can taste it, but you can't take it out. You can't isolate it. You don't know what is culture and what's not culture, what it has to do with just business and things. So I would say getting a healthy attitude to the role of culture, not over or underestimating it. I think on the individual level, I think some people a danger is that some people are very attracted to stereotypes. So if they discover the topic, they say, now I want a list of do's and don'ts for China or whatever. And that's dangerous, because those do's and don'ts can never reflect the complexity of the situation. And the other thing on the company or organizational level, I think, is that still people are underestimating the role of culture in the organizational development. Or when they do a change program worldwide, or when they do a merger or acquisition, often people are very focused on the hard facts, on the financials, on getting things going. And I appreciate that they're under a lot of pressure to get the deal done, but they don't actually think about then the cultural mix of these of the company perhaps that they're acquiring, or the process that they're trying to introduce in a different place. So I would say it basically comes down to taking culture seriously and not trying to oversimplify things with by drifting into the stereotypes, because that's counterproductive.
Yeah, no, I really like, and that's an excellent point. I've seen, I'm sure, when large companies, or when they go inorganic and buy a company, and there's clash of this, you know, a very hierarchical culture versus a very friendly culture, yep, one part of the world or one part of the company. So I'm thinking just from now an HR lens, are there, I know, for instance, like personalities, we will have some instruments to find. Are there something in the domain of culture as well, where maybe, if, as like I said, if a company is serious and they really believe in, you know, I was reading a book where they were giving examples of companies like Procter & Gamble and Unilever and GE and some of these other companies who do a very good job of talent succession. They actually plan and say that, look, if you wish to grow in our firm, you will have to move out of, you know, from A location to B, and then, you know, get a global experience. So is there a way for companies, I mean, are there tools or instruments that which can kind of give them a scorecard, if you will, that just says that, hey, listen.
No.
Okay.
I mean, that's an important thing, because obviously companies need to measure things and manage things. And at Siemens, we had when I was there, we had a competency framework, where they identified the key competencies for leaders. And I was very pleased when they included, they called it intercultural sensitivity. That was one of those. And they defined levels of intercultural sensitivity. And that was something which then was in the whole development of the, it was involved with the recruitment of people. And then it was involved in the development process. So when I had my performance management meeting with my boss, he had to give me like a grade for this topic, alongside other things, decision making or whatever. There are some, I list some in my book and explain them a little bit more than I can do now. Sure. But there are some tools out there which some people find helpful. One developed by somebody called Milton Bennett some years ago, which I think is quite good, is called the International Development Inventory (IDI), and that looks at people and tries to identify what stage of intercultural development they're at. Because I would see basically five stages of being interculturally competent. As you said at the beginning, and we repeated, it's not like riding a bicycle. You can do it, you can't do it. It's something which you can have degrees of. So I think the first stage in intercultural development is accepting culture. Accepting there are differences, not saying everybody is the same. Then somehow understanding them, sort of saying, okay, I now know why this is the case. Then to move towards adapting, so dealing with this. Maybe you need to switch codes when you're talking to people, or you have to change your behavior. Then actually effectively functioning in the culture. And the fifth stage is what I call bridging culture. So you're like mediating between cultures. So you can define then behaviors, which this IDI, for instance, does, which are linked to these various stages, and say, okay, and you get people to talk about their encounters. And if they say, no, I think everybody's the same and we're a global company, then you realize they're in a very low level of this intercultural competence. There are some other tools as well, which go a bit deeper. One is called the Cultural Orientations Indicator. I've used that with various companies. Actually, I'm trained to use that as a particular tool. And there's another one which I really like called the Intercultural Readiness Check. I think I would you can find these online. Well, as I say, I mentioned them in my book, and you can find the one that suits you. There's not one size that fits all. And I would be a bit careful with them because they're not magic. You know, I think the most important thing with your is to get into some dialogue with people about where they talk about their experiences, and then you see where their development is. But the tool can be these tools can be an indicator, and I think the field is becoming much more scientific now than it was when I got started in 20 years ago.
Yeah, excellent. No, I really like you mentioned three specific ones, but the idea again is to use them as some kind of a benchmark, if you will, just to say that, hey, listen, maybe if I'm a six, I think I can go and become an eight, or maybe the instrument gives us that feedback, right? And so I think that's
good. What I actually meant is really to use them as a basis for discussion. So for instance, this cultural orientations indicator, which I'm most familiar with because I got trained to use it. Mm-hmm. I was asked to coach some people in a very large logistics company worldwide. And they, although they're active worldwide, they didn't feel that the people had such an international mindset, you know. And so they said, we want to coach these were key people in the management. So we got them to do this online test. And that was, I got the results. And then they had like a 1 hour coaching session with me. And I found that very useful. The useful thing was not just the results. It was the discussion which was based on that. So you've got some basis, and you'd say, well, I was interested why you, maybe didn't do so well at this part of this test, and you did very well at this part. And then you build on that, and then that increases the awareness of people. So I would say these instruments should be used in connection with coaching, with training, with dialogue.
Yeah, excellent. No, absolutely. It's a good basis for conversation. But now let me just to extend that thought, Robert. If you're, as you said in the beginning that, you know, look, it's a process, it's a journey of sorts. And for many of us, right, perhaps there comes a stage in our career that where maybe I've made a few trips to, in Asia, for instance, and then I've learned a little more about the Asian culture, even though I may be based in Asia. And so you move up this trajectory, or you move up this ladder, but at some point you're actually leading a multicultural team, right? And maybe you haven't undergone an instrument or whatever, or formal training, right? What are some of the do's and don'ts? And I look at my own experience, like I was leading a team where we had about 15 people, half the team was in Singapore, but even from that team there, we had one girl from Finland. We had someone from France. We had someone from the UK, and two people from China. And even within India, we had people from different parts. So again, there was a lot of learning for me almost. And I think much of that came when I was speaking one-on-one and so on. But oftentimes in a large setting, it was almost like, okay, what do I say, which kind of lands for everybody? So any general tips of some of the do's and don'ts, like, or someone who's going to now lead a multicultural team.
Yep. Yeah. That's something which very much interests me, because I think that's a particular skill, and I also had that privilege to have a multicultural team, and I realized when I had my team, it was a question of taking a bit of time to recognize the cultures of the team, so where people were coming from. Of course, some of it's individual personality, but some of it's influenced by culture, and saying, well, what are the strengths of these people? So I remember quite well when I was trying to get my international team to produce a presentation, and they were going to have to present at the employee meeting with several hundred people, and where they had to present our strategy for our department to everybody else, and quite a critical audience and so forth. And I remember the first meeting, I thought this could be chaotic. You know, everybody's talking at cross purposes, saying that we're not saying anything at all. And I thought, maybe as well just do it myself, you know. And but then I realized, I thought, no, I don't want to do it myself, and I shouldn't do it myself. And I'm supposed to be an interculturalist, so I should be able to handle this, you know. So I realized that actually one of the German colleagues, she was more sort of quiet person. She was very good at doing the research. So I got her doing, you know, finding the documents and doing the sort of back office stuff. And there was somebody else, an American guy, actually. He was very good at presenting. Everybody found him very, very powerful. He was excellent with an international audience, but he wasn't sort of a details person. You know, he just was very vague when he talked. So I thought, okay, he's going to be our presenter. And then I thought, well, what's my role? And there was other people, of course. And I thought, well, my role, I don't want to, my role maybe is just to coordinate this, you know, and to be in the background, although I was the leader of the team. There's a very interesting list, I think, which comes from another book, which is by, has been around for a long time, a guy called Terence Brake. And Terence Brake wrote a book called Where in the World is My Team? And he calls them the six C's of global virtual collaboration, or running like a multicultural team, particularly in a virtual setting, which many people are doing. Many of you are doing, as people are listening to this, I'm sure you're working in virtual teams. And so the six C's are, the first one is cooperation, which is basically building trust with people. And you need to, and people, trust is based on different things in different places. You know how to, have to know how to build trust. Is trust coming from people seeing you as competent as a manager or a leader? Or is it based on charisma or whatever? So you need to, anyway, but you need this trust. You need what he calls convergence. This means you need to make it clear what the common goal is. And I found that actually even very disparate teams, if they've got a very clear goal, they will get there. You know, we wanted to do training at one time for Bayern Munich, for the football team, because we said they must need intercultural training. They've got so many people, players from all over the world, but they don't actually, because they're so focused on winning the match and they're so focused on their football, they don't actually maybe necessarily need that, although they probably get that. So having a clear purpose as convergence. Next one is coordination. That's really making sure everybody's working in the same way, using the same tools and processes. Capability, using those skills that I mentioned in my team, so recognizing what's in those people, finding a way of communicating. So that's the fifth C. Deciding how you're going to communicate, because people will have different preferences. Some people might prefer an email, some people prefer a call, some people prefer a text message, some people prefer some shared site where you've got all the documents or whatever. So you need to really work out how you're going to do that and agree on it. It will be different for every team. There's no unique, every team is unique, and there will be no universal way of doing this. And the other one is really to try to identify the cultural preferences and use them for advantage, because basically we know that multicultural teams, if they're well managed and well constituted, they're likely to be more innovative and more closer to customers and actually financially more successful than monocultural teams. If they're not well led, by the way, then they lose value, and you just spend a lot of time talking across purposes and not getting anything done. But if you want to be innovative, which is so important these days, particularly in many areas, then you really need different perspectives, and you need someone, and that's the exciting role, I think, of the leader, who's able to bring this together and coordinate that.
No, excellent. Yeah, I really like the 6C example, and that could be kind of a frame that person can use. So final couple of questions, Robert. One, of course, just as a way to kind of close out, I want to ask, like, let's say, so given this is for our Gen Z population, what can the Gen Z young manager do or don't as they enter into the workforce? So what advice would you have for them? So we heard, you know, what companies are doing. We heard the mistakes companies can make. We heard how you kind of, you know, become better with time. We heard about the tools and instruments. How do you lead a team? But if I'm a fresh graduate, right, I'm just entering my sort of the 40-year career that I have ahead of me, what can I do something before coming into my in the work system? Are there some basic tips?
Yeah, I mean, before you join a company it's worth doing some research into the people and finding out about them, looking at their background, but not just looking at, say, okay, this is an American, so they must be like this, but actually looking at the individual. So actually, on a practical level, when I have an important client meeting, I take a look at their LinkedIn profile and see, well, where's this person coming from? What's their background? And so you might want to look at their professional background, their national background, their international experience, the jobs that they've done. So you find out, you do a lot of research there. When you're in the company or in an organization, again, this observation skill is very important. So if you know, people say to me, well, how am I supposed to dress in the office? Like, well, you look around and you see, how are those people, what are they wearing? And then you can make a statement and wear something different, but you can also say, okay, I shouldn't dress too formally, or I have to dress more formally, whatever. Yeah. I think it's also very important to be able to ask a lot of questions. And so before you make assumptions, to spend a bit of time asking, not telling people, this is what you're like, but just asking very open questions about how things are done. And people will understand that if you're new, that you ask questions. And if you want to ask about culture, people are often very, very happy to talk about that, you know? So, I mean, I have that all the time when I go to China. I'm going there next week, and I may have to ask, local people, what do I bring if I'm invited to somebody's house? What's appropriate? Yeah. I know some things are taboo, and you don't take an umbrella as a present because that means you never want to see the people again or whatever. But it's unique to every situation. And you need to find that. That's where you need another thing. You need to find some, I call, local informants. So somebody in the organization who you can trust, who's able to talk to you. And those people are not necessarily super high up in the hierarchy.
Right.
If you're talking to the big boss or whatever, they may not, there's too much power going on there, to be honest. So you can get a lot of information maybe from a team assistant, maybe from a fellow, from somebody on an internship or something, who really knows how that organization ticks, and they can help you. And they will tell you the unique things about this organization. You know, what do people do at lunchtime? How do they celebrate somebody's birthday or not, or whatever, which you can not get from a book. I would urge people, though, also to not lose their authenticity. You're really valuable for an organization, not because you've got massive experience, which you don't have,
yeah,
but because you're coming with a fresh mind, and you can be proud of that, actually, and it's very, very useful. And don't be arrogant and say, oh, you should do things in this way or something like that on the first day, but you can offer your perspectives, and you may well be saying things that the other people would have liked to say, but they've stopped asking these questions. I found that when I joined this big company, I was completely confused by all the abbreviations they were using. They had acronyms for everything, you know? And so quite naively, I would say at a meeting, sorry, you used this, whatever it was. What does that mean? And then it was amazing because people had been there 10 years. They said, actually, we're not quite sure either, you know? And it was not a problem. So asking those things in a open, curious way, but not in a not in an arrogant or aggressive way, then you would alienate people.
Yeah. No. Excellent. Wow. Very good suggestions from research to just sort of, you know, having the curiosity, having the humility to kind of be yourself. I mean, be authentic, but also being humble enough to kind of learn, right? And I think
that's right. Yeah.
So final couple of questions, Robert. One, of course, any final kind of piece of advice as we close out? But I also, second, that's one. Number two, can you tell us a little bit about the book that you've written, and where can people find more information about the book? because I think you've shared some really good nuggets from the book itself, which I'd like our viewers to check it out, in addition to the insights today.
Thank you very much. I always have basically three sort of tips, which are very general things, which I think would apply to this generation, but also to many other people as well. I think, and they sum up a little bit what we've been talking about. So the first one is really taking culture seriously. That it's a topic that is not, people say, oh, it's a soft skill and all the rest of it, but it really has hard impact. Things can collapse. It's not easy to pin down. It's not easy to measure. And maybe it's immeasurable, but it's certainly something you can feel and it's there. So take it seriously. Don't overdo it, but make sure you recognize those things. And culture in the sense of national culture or regional culture or generational culture as well. When you get into it, don't reduce everything to some list of do's and don'ts and stereotypes. You asked me a couple of times do's and don'ts. I'm a little bit allergic to this do's and don'ts, but I try to twist them around to be more general things.
Right.
But don't expect anything to be too specific, because actually a culture is I call it a cocktail. It's a mixture of all sorts of things, and it's very complex. And the last one is when you start thinking about diversity and inclusion, realize that actually diversity is only one part of it. So actually, if you're applying for a job with a company and they say they're very diverse, and you look at the people and they say, oh, this is a diverse group, you need to also think about how much the people feel they belong to that company. How do they feel included? Because I saw companies hiring very diverse people, but then the people left after a couple of years because they didn't really feel welcome or belonging in the company. So yeah, it's not just diversity, it's diversity and inclusion and belonging.
Yeah.
So a couple of works about the book here, so I can show it to you. It's called Bridge the Culture Gaps. And you should be able to get it in India. There's from Amazon India. They do have it there. I checked. And you can get it as a paperback like this, of course.
Yeah.
But you can also get it as an ebook and as an audiobook. I'm quite surprised, actually. I found the audiobook is doing very well in some countries. I didn't even think about it when I agreed to write the book. It was going to be an audiobook, but I hadn't realized. I don't know, I'd be interested if Generation Z, if you're into audiobooks, but I'm finding more and more people actually are doing that.
Yeah.
Do get hold of it. If you like it, write a little review on Amazon, because that really is great for me. And the ebook is really very inexpensive, actually. I mean, for a time it was 99 euro cents, you know, and now it's gone up to sensible price, but I don't know quite the price in India. But if you want a quick thing and it's handy, but I'm quite proud of the book because it's got some nice illustrations. So I would encourage you to get hold of that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for the advertising slot.
No, so lovely, Robert. I really do want it to, because I think we're really kind of, for the younger generation, they're connected at one level with technology and everything. But again, there could be this blind spot about, you know, because I watch an American sitcom or I watch that English movie or whatever, I think I'm culturally savvy. And I think we
absolutely
just
do. Very deceptive. Yeah.
So we just need to be a little cautious there and really just, you know, become better with listening to experts like you. So I'm happy. I think this has been one wonderful conversation where you've laid out a lot of good tips. And I would going to encourage everybody to check out the book. Simply because you've taken years of experience and amassed it into a simple book. I'm looking forward to checking it out. Thank you for kind of sending me that invite. So I'm going to check it out as well. And especially because I have two Gen Z boys, and I tell them that, you know, hey, listen, don't think you're a cat whisker, because the world today is very different. And, you know, just when you kind of overestimate or have a higher perception of something, right, you'll be quickly kind of shown the mirror, right? So I think it's good to hear and learn the basics, learn from an expert. So hope people can check out the book, your frameworks, and obviously this episode as well. So Robert, once again, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation on a topic which was long overdue for my podcast, and I'm happy that you were able to shed a lot of light. I look forward if your travels bring you to India to perhaps meet you in person.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for having me. And it's been very interesting talking to you. And Yeah, I mean, for all the problems and things, it's really a wonderful topic, and I just enjoy every intercultural encounter, and that's why I like traveling so much, and why I'm looking forward to my next trips. So I would final advice to you, everybody, is to just enjoy those intercultural encounters. And yes. I found so often at business meetings, which can be very dry and some very technical topic, what do people talk about in the bar in the evening? They're talking about this cultural thing because it's it's really interesting and yes. fascinating. And I hope that I can infect you with that enthusiasm.
No, absolutely. And at some point, maybe if our travels cross, we'll share a coffee or a drink. Maybe exchange some more stories. I'm sure you have so many more stories. So looking forward to that. And thank you once again, Robert. Wishing you safe travels over your next trip. I will talk to you soon. Thank you.
Okay. All the best. Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Working with Gen Z. I hope you learned and gained new insights as I did on understanding the Gen Z population a little bit better. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please share this with someone who you think would benefit from the ideas and the insights shared on this episode. Please note, we also have a video version of this episode on the YouTube channel called Working with Gen Z. You can find that version on that YouTube channel. Secondly, I would really appreciate if you could leave a review of this episode on Apple Podcasts so it will help us to reach out to new listeners for the show. Make sure you subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other platform you're listening to your podcast on. I would really appreciate if you could leave me a review and tell us what did you like. Tell us what we can improve to help you understand this very important generation. Finally, as always, you can learn the many basics of the Gen Z generation through the book Target Gen Z, your guide to understanding the Gen Z mindset on brands, work-life learning, and more. This book is available both on the Kindle and the paperback formats on Amazon. Till such time, I look forward to seeing you in the very next episode. See you soon.